help out on kickoffs and punts. This was one of the many grueling tests we gave newly arrived players in Cleveland. Emphasizing special teams toughness helps install the all-in vibe up and down the roster. That was why Belichick ruled that virtually every player must contribute to the various special teams units. Metcalf was a former number one draft choice. So was Eric Turner. Turner, Belichick's first pick as Browns head coach, would become an all-pro safety, but he was precisely the kind of strong, athletic player Belichick loved to see on his special teams. In Cleveland, we became so focused on developing our special teams with that type of talent that our defensive coordinator, Nick Saban, complained about how his side of the ball was always being slighted, forced as it was to incorporate lesser players because they also could help the kicking game. Before he sent his punt return team onto the field, special teams coach Scott O'Brien made sure his group understood that he wanted them to set up a right sideline return. That means the jammers, blockers, on both ends of the line have to do a great job of blocking the Steelers' gunners, the punt team's best cover men, and generally the first defenders downfield. Earlier in the game, Metcalf took one back 91 yards for a touchdown with a left sideline return, and O'Brien knows that if Royals makes a tactical mistake and punts down the middle of the field, a right return, the play he called, will be the shortest path to the end zone. But on the right return, the responsibility of jamming the gunners falls to a couple of exhausted defenders. Turner and fellow safety Stephon Moore. Turner and Moore had played their hearts out all day. These stars of the defense are also special team stalwarts. Being exhausted is no excuse. Their teammates need them. In reality, they secretly love the violent chaos of punt return duty. If all goes as planned, Turner will go to the left side of the Steelers line, jam his man, peel off, and race across the field to help set up offensive blockers that will lead Metcalf up the right sideline in front of the Cleveland bench. Moore will align to the right side and jam his man inside toward the middle of the field and then race backward to help seal the sideline for Metcalf. Belichick has called off any rush of the punter to better set up the return, hoping the extra time causes Royals to relax a bit and overswing on the kick rather than direct it to a sideline. And the tactic works. Royals' kick is headed exactly where we hoped it would go, straight down the middle of the field toward the most explosive talent in the NFL. Many NFL teams give certain players dispensation to avoid particular team drills, but I've never seen that do anything except divide the group into haves and have-nots. That was certainly the case in Oakland. During the 2005 season, I was driving home from Friday practice to have dinner with my family when I got a call from Al Davis. "How could you let them work him so hard?" Davis yelled into the phone, to which I naturally asked, "Who is him?" In his angrier by the second Brooklyn accent, Davis answered simply, "Alvis." "Ah, Alvis Whitted, our fourth wide receiver." My still flummoxed response, "Do what?" only got him more riled. "Let him run down kickoffs," he clarified. "We have to save his legs." When I pointed out that we needed guys to cover kicks too, Al followed with his signature, "Ah, fuck," and hung up. Whitted did have incredible speed, but he was the fourth or fifth option at his position, exactly the kind of guy who fills coverage units. We couldn't exempt him. Here's what separates the most subtle football thinkers from the rest. They know that special teams account for nearly 20% of all plays during a game, and they're not willing to forgo the chance to gain an advantage over an opponent in one-fifth of the available opportunities. But most coaches and owners are happy to just get off the field with clean exchanges, that is, no turnovers. They're not evenly concerned with field position because you can turn field position with one deep pass. Davis was one of those guys. He wasn't interested in risking the health of his starters and primary backups such as Whitted on a unit that to him didn't matter strategically. He certainly wasn't thinking about building a foundation of teamwork atop the unit. Guys like Belichick, though, believe firmly that an all-in culture is a central piece of championship equation and that special teams are the fastest path to it. Davis, in all fairness, loved specialists. He drafted punter Ray Guy and kicker Sebastian Janikowski in the first round, and so it would be hard to knock him for not loving the special teams. He just didn't love using his fast players from the offense to cover kicks. He found his edge in other places. For one thing, he saw the advantage of forcing opponents to field a ball kicked by a left-footed punter, particularly when they had no experience at it. Davis understood that the ball comes off a left foot with a different rotation, making it a challenge to catch. Plus, left-footers are rare, which means returners don't have a lot of practice dealing with that rotation. Davis would hire left-footers when he could, and he always made sure to bring one in to practice the week before we were set to face one. And now Belichick does that too. Another reason for Belichick's obsession with special teams is that they allow coaches to interact with more of the team at once. Offensive and defensive coordinators just manage guys in their unit, but the kicking games use players from both sides of the ball. Aside from a full team meeting, the special teams meeting is the largest regular gathering. Sure, most of the players at that meeting are from the back end of the roster, but a second tier that is strong and nourished pushes frontline players as well as any cash bonus or contract incentive. Belichick isn't the first coach I saw use special teams to change the broader culture. When Kansas State hired Bill Schneider to be its head coach in 1989, the program was among the worst in college football. Schneider took over a program that had gone 27 games without a win. In the 53 years before his arrival, the Wildcats won 137 games total. A couple years earlier, I had sat in the stands in Manhattan, Kansas, watching a practice as a Niners scout and wondering if anyone could ever have success there. And then Schneider put up 136 wins in 17 seasons. He won many of those games with a wide-open offense and by taking advantage of the instant upgrades that junior college transfers offered. But it was from the kicking game that he concocted that all-important, all-in atmosphere. Just recently, Schneider shared with me that he knew going into the project that turning around Kansas State would mean building tough-minded players. He also knew that excelling in the kicking game was something all coaches said they wanted, but rarely spent the effort to achieve. That is why Schneider walked the walk from the beginning, devoting as much practice time to that unit as he did to the others. Schneider still boasts about how much time he spent on the kicking game. There's no magic to any of it. It's simply a function of the head coach's level of attention. Schneider once said, "You think about the number of repetitions in a course of a ball game that you get in some aspect of special teams, and it's pretty substantial, so it deserves the time you invest in it." When Schneider landed in Kansas, he was determined to make starters play on special teams because that was how he was going to create what I call the tornado effect. All-in teams are in fact a bit like tornadoes, disparate energies that band together into a single destructive force that cuts down everything in its path. The greatest example of this concept is the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team. Coach Herb Brooks didn't collect the best hockey players in America for his squad. Rather, he found the right players. To help put together the roster, Brooks, a psychology major, gave each prospect a lengthy test in which he was looking for high scores in three areas: open-mindedness, willingness to learn, and coachability. He felt those interrelated qualities would allow him to build a team that could overcome the large talent gap it would confront as college kids playing against the best teams from around the globe. The Soviets had won every hockey gold since 1964, outscoring opponents 175-44 in international play and crushing the NHL All-Stars 6-0 in 1979 with a backup goalie, no less. That Soviet team was the best hockey team in history, but Brooks beat it with a bench full of misfits and maybe the greatest all-in culture ever created. No wonder, then, that Belichick admired the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team. He admired it so much that he gave its players access to the most protected inner sanctum in sports, his locker room. In New England, Belichick invited goalie Jim Craig to tell the Patriots about how he flat-out refused to take Brooks' famous test. The coach relented, but just before the winter games were to begin, he told Craig that he was thinking of starting someone else in the net. Craig went nuts yelling, "Is it? Because I didn't take your stupid test? Brooks answered. No, it's because I want the guy back who refused to take the test. Craig was losing his fire and Brooks wanted to ignite it like Lake Placid's Olympic torch. Craig was a tremendous storyteller, but he spent very little time talking about his legendary 36-save performance against the Russians, one of the greatest Olympic performances of all time. 2 minutes into his speech, though, every Patriots player saw what Belichick had seen in Craig, a kindred spirit. Just like most of the players in New England, Craig was a special teamer at heart. Instead of talking about himself, he focused on the power of the 1980 team's all-in nature and the unique collection of teammates that built it. Belichick was trying to build something equally psychotic in New England and wanted his special teams to spur the team-wide storm. I have been a part of 4 Super Bowl teams, and all were all-in types. There simply has to be a thread of unity running through any successful team, from the best players to the practice squad. I'm not saying they all have to like one another, but there has to at least be some level of mutual respect. So when a head coach like Belichick makes special teams a priority, treating those mostly unknown and underpaid players with the same respect as the all-pros on offense and defense, and sometimes with more, it's a powerful message about trust and accountability that resonates with all 53 men in the locker room. Turner, the big, fast, hard-hitting safety from UCLA, was football and book smart, fully prepared to lead the defense even though he was younger than anyone else on the unit. But he was exceptional in another way, too. From the beginning, he wanted to play on special teams, and he was very good at it. We counted on him to contribute to both of our coverage units, and he elevated them both. If he needed a break, we'd give him one. But at critical points of every game, he wanted to be out there, and we were happy to oblige. All of the best, most competitive players I've been around are exactly the same, willing to do whatever it takes. I was at the University of Miami in 1988 working out some hurricanes on the box, which is basically an electric timer that clocks a series of drills. This was data solely about athletic skill, not football instinct. The key to box drills was that they were run on a wood surface for consistency's sake, and that meant I often found myself conducting workouts on campus basketball courts, a massive highlight for the serious college hoops fan. Even today, when I watch games on TV, I think fondly of my boxing days and all the janitors I pissed off by ripping the gloss off their shiny floors when I pulled up the tape I'd laid down as players' marks. Anyway, Michael Irvin, Miami's star receiver, wasn't likely to agree to participate, so I had to improvise. When I made a call to set up a workout, I was not 100% truthful. You see, I gave Irvin the impression that I was actually Marty Schottenheimer, the head coach of the Browns. Irvin had no reason to doubt me, and without caller ID, no way to check even if he did. But when Irvin arrived at the gym to find a fat, low-level Italian, he was like, no way am I working out for you, before walking over to join a hoops game with some of his football teammates. I still had to work out other players, and as I put them through their paces, I kept noticing Irvin sneaking glances at the box. He was curious, but more than that, he was competitive. He wanted to prove he could test better than anyone else. Before I left that day, Irvin had completed the test, and yes, his scores were outstanding. Irvin accepted a challenge to prove his talents, and that's not unusual for the great ones. It's the main reason that creating an all-in team with buy-in from the stars, even when that means getting them to participate on special teams, isn't as hard as you might expect. Great competitors want to conquer every challenge, and that is a win-win for special teams coach because getting the most talented guys to line up with the kicking units can make them dominant. If relying on their competitive streak fails, sometimes a piece of clothing may be enough to get the message across. You'd think the modern football professional would be too rich and too adult to fall for a typical high school motivational methods. Never. NFL players are still helpless before the power of the t-shirt. To help create the culture he wanted in Cleveland, Belichick gave the special teams a nickname, the Strike Force, and each week rewarded top achievers with a brown shirt that proclaimed Strike Force champion across the chest. The top performer got a leather jacket. From high school to college to the pros, locker rooms don't change. Sure, NFLers own expensive cars and thick financial portfolios. It doesn't matter. Competitive sorts aren't about to let the opportunity to snag a free shirt pass. In fact, stars might covet those shirts most of all. Belichick required players to participate on at least one kicking unit, but by season's end, even the best players were pushing to be on more, hoping to raise their chances of earning a t-shirt or that prize jacket. Like a smooth major league center fielder, Metcalf has taken two steps backwards, calculating precisely where the ball will drop into his soft hands. His eyes never leave the ball. Instead, he lets his internal clock tell him exactly how close the defenders are getting. To do this, he must trust completely that his teammates will protect him. The other key, he knows, is the first 5 yards of the return. If he can get a clean takeoff, Metcalf has an excellent chance to gobble up some major yardage. Turner and Stephon Moore, along with fellow defensive backs Stacy Hairston and Terry Taylor, have done the dirty work, battling the Steelers' gunners tooth and nail on the line, preventing them from getting a clean, quick path down the field. Metcalf catches the ball on the Browns' 25-yard line and takes two quick decoy steps straight up the center of the field. It's a gutsy game of chicken, meant to draw tacklers away from the right return coming together on the edge. Metcalf hopes that the rest of the unit can stand tall and hold back the onslaught of tacklers. The strike force comes through. All around Metcalf is a barrage of human projectiles colliding in a kaleidoscope of brown and yellow jerseys. Bodies fly by in all directions at maximum velocity. The violence of a punt return is breathtaking, really. Everywhere you look, players are putting their bodies and their livelihood on the line to protect or destroy the returner. You can't force players to do this. They have to want to do it for one another. Moore even doubles back to race 50 yards downfield, just in time to make a perfect diving and legal block that springs Metcalf toward the safety of the sidelines and the protection of his blockers, including 295-pound defensive tackle James Jones. That Moore and Jones were perfectly positioned to help spring Metcalf's return was no coincidence. Rather, it was a byproduct of years of careful planning and roster building by our staff. My first job in football was as a volunteer coach at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, in charge of making coffee for head coach Harvey Hyde. I also was a car washer, fill up the gas tank guy, and errand boy. The job was neither glamorous nor high paying, but it was a start. After my two successful seasons as barista in chief, a young coach from the University of Wisconsin Superior drove his shiny new Corvette into town, looking for something to do while his wife attended graduate school. That coach was Scott O'Brien. O'Brien and I quickly formed a football friendship that became a lifelong relationship. It didn't hurt that he soon replaced me as the official coffee maker, although I always thought he skimped a bit on the grounds. He had been on the Packers practice squad on the defensive line, but he loved special teams. I mean, he really loved them. Some aspiring coaches are forever drawing plays on scraps of paper. Hell, if someone ever snatched any of my notebooks in college, they would have no luck finding the daily lessons amid the pages and pages of play diagrams. Did I mention that I was an awful student? Similarly, O'Brien's journals featured alley returns for kickoffs and attacking scheme for punt blocks and ways to check into the best return on kickoffs no matter where the opponent kicked the ball. He had an excellent understanding of schemes and what players needed to do to make those schemes work. He was special teams 24/7, and he couldn't wait to teach what he knew, which was quite a bit. After I left UNLV for the 49ers, O'Brien and I kept in close touch. His career took him to Rice, then to the University of Pittsburgh, where the head coach was another good friend, Mike Gottfried. Naturally, when he was looking for a special teams coach, I told him to interview O'Brien. By the time O'Brien was in Pittsburgh, I was close by in Cleveland, so we saw each other more frequently, and when the Browns hired longtime NFL defensive coordinator Bud Carson as head coach in 1989, I saw my chance to get O'Brien to Cleveland. I had no prior relationship with Carson, so I knew it would be a hard sell. Deciding I'd take the same tack that worked with Godfrey, just meet the guy, I marched into Carson's office. I wasn't four sentences in when Carson said, "What the fuck would I want with some college guy coaching my special teams?" 2 years later, I got a second chance when Belichick replaced Carson. Belichick and I had no prior relationship either, but this time when I talked up my friend, I had an interested audience. A few days later, O'Brien arrived at the Brio, Ohio training facility. Belichick, dressed in a coat and tie, immediately escorted him into his office. Every so often, I peeked down the hall to see if the door had opened, but nothing. 2 hours went by, then three, then four. Finally, after 6 hours of nonstop nerding out about special teams, Belichick walked down to my office to thank me for the recommendation. O'Brien got the job. On top of being a great special teams coach, O'Brien was a great talent evaluator. A few years into the job, he made a particularly astute recommendation. When our punter's leg began to age out, we went shopping for a replacement. O'Brien wanted us to sign Tom Tupa, a local kid from Brecksville, Ohio. Tupa had been a great punter at Ohio State, but he had also been a decent quarterback, and the Phoenix Cardinals chose him in the third round in 1988 to fill that higher profile position. In his first 6 years in the NFL, Tupa punted just 6 times, and when he was released by the Colts, we brought him to camp as our backup quarterback. He didn't make the team and ended up sitting out the 1993 season. But while he was around for those few weeks of camp, O'Brien urged him to get back to punting. The next season, his booming leg and the bonus of a viable passing dimension as a holder of kicks made him a vital piece of the team. It was the first year of the two-point conversion, and naturally, Tupa was the first to score one. Soon, he was Tommy Two-Point around the office. The kicking game allows teams to improve their overall talent level without having to navigate the usual interleague competition for available players. The NFL procurement system is designed to favor the losers, as poor records earn higher draft positions. But in the draft, those teams are looking for immediate help, players who can make an offense or defense better now. What they are not looking for are players whose skill sets can be honed over time on special teams. This lack of interest in that kind of player creates a variance in the market for those looking for, well, let's just call it special talent. O'Brien's ability to find these hidden gems was so uncanny that we built a whole strategy around it. We believed that if a player was a standout in the kicking game, he had a good chance of developing into an effective four-down player, assuming he was smart enough to learn the relevant playbook. And the more four-down players we accumulated, the better we would be. Take Stephon Moore, for example. His trajectory illustrates a best-case scenario in Belichick's universe. Moore had been a free agent most recently with Miami. As he did with every potential pickup, O'Brien graded him accordingly to how many kickoff teams he thought he could contribute to. Meanwhile, the position coach graded him on strictly defensive criteria. Then Belichick and I assigned a grade that was based on projected overall contribution for the upcoming season and the one after. We also built a specific plan for growing Moore into a four-down guy, which included one of O'Brien's assistants, Kevin Spencer, teaching him, along with a promising group of 10 or 12 others, the rest of the playbook. Moore eventually was a starting strong safety for us, but he never stopped being an excellent special teams player. We had to coach up Moore to make him the player he would become, but we never had any doubt that he was a Belichick player. Most of them scream out to you the moment you lay eyes on them. In the spring before our first draft together in 1991, Belichick and I did a one-day three-city tour of Iowa, kind of like we were on the campaign trail for the state's caucus. We were coming mainly for Iowa's star running back, Nick Bell. Bell was a big man, not just for a running back, but for any position. The problem was he never played as big or as tough as his size. We had an internal disagreement in the scouting department over his value and role, and this trip was meant to decide whether he would make our final draft board. When we touched down in Iowa City, we learned that Bell was not too interested in working out for us. He especially didn't want to be timed in the 40-yard dash. Throughout my career, I found that most prospects are willing to do skill work and strength work, but hate the 40, not least because they know that a bad time can offset every good time in their file. We didn't need to time Bell. His athleticism was not an issue for us, but his lack of desire to run was telling. Unfortunately for him, it also gave us more time to interview him and assess his competitiveness. Leaving Iowa City, we headed north, and as I drove along Highway 380, we talked about what we had just learned. 1. Bell was neither particularly physically or mentally tough, so 2. He wasn't a good fit for our special teams. Before our car pulled into the parking spot near the University of Northern Iowa's indoor stadium, it was decided we would not be drafting Nick Bell. We had only one player to work out in Cedar Rapids. That was James Jones, who, his agent Jack Wirth kept telling me, was going to be the steal of the draft. Wirth was selling his client, sure, but he was a good judge of talent. He scouted players himself, attending games and handpicking his client base. We were already a little intrigued. James was excellent on tape, dominating the competition, and playing with intensity. But we needed to project his skill set to the next level. Could he play that way against the pros? The workout would give us clues. As we entered the football office to meet Jones, he was waiting for us in the small reception area, a good sign. We followed Jones down to the field, where I set up our usual pre-workout drill, 4 large circular bags laid on the ground for players to maneuver over and between. It loosens them up for the rest of the workout while allowing us to judge their quickness, balance, and athleticism. A Belichick workout never began without the bags. Jones killed in all the drills, from the bags to position-specific tests. During those workouts, Belichick is particularly interested in a prospect's power. We set up 2 cones 5 yards apart. Then, from a 2-point stance, the player follows Belichick as he walks from one cone to the other. At some point, Belichick turns parallel to the player, at which point the player is supposed to punch the coach's chest and keep moving. This tight jab gives Belichick an idea of the prospect's quick strike force and often sore ribs. On this day, Jones was Mike Tyson, delivering a blow that I thought was going to earn an 8-count. When the workout was over, the guy was on our draft board and Belichick was walking a little hunched over. We drafted Jones in the 3rd round in 1991, and he immediately became a 4-down player and a hero, I suppose, to everyone in football who has ever fantasized about hitting Belichick really, really hard. Jones clears the way for Metcalf to get to the sidelines before lugging his nearly 300-pound frame upfield to find someone else to pancake. As the return is developing, Steeler linebacker Reggie Barnes has the best shot at Metcalf, but the returner's elite speed catapults him out of reach. The interaction lasts for only a fraction of a second, but it is a definitive justification of Belichick's singular approach to special teams. Metcalf is a former first-round pick, surrounded by blockers who double as starters, but the one guy the Steelers have asked to prevent the game-winning touchdown is Barnes, an undrafted rookie free agent thrown onto special teams as an afterthought, who takes a sloppy tackling angle and comes up with nothing but air. At midfield, Metcalf cuts inside, allowing the Browns to plow a few Steelers halfway onto the Cleveland bench. Out of nowhere, and maybe trying to make up for his poorly aimed punt, Royals appears in front of Metcalf. That is when he's atomized by Jones. Somehow, Jones stays on his feet and manages to stiff-arm Steelers tight end Tim Jordan, yet another undrafted rookie free agent, before he can get a clean shot at Metcalf. At the 15, one last Steeler backup dives for Metcalf's legs, but he is chopped down by Taylor, who has covered nearly 115 yards and blocked 4 different tacklers in less than 10 seconds. Metcalf high steps his way through the end zone, stopped by the only thing that has been able to accomplish that in the game, the bursting barricades of the infamous Cleveland Dog Pound, its boisterous celebration seemingly slingshotting Metcalf back into the end zone where he's mobbed by teammates. To make this moment even more perfect, for me at least, the stadium speakers blast Springsteen's Born to Run. Chapter 5. Offense. Finding the seams. If we are all thinking alike, no one is thinking. Bill Walsh. Bill wants a meeting. Combine those two words, Bill and once, and stuff happened. Everyone who worked for the 49ers perked up, paying close attention to whatever came next. Bill Wentz could move mountains. Bill Wentz could make or break careers. Just days before the critical 1987 draft, what Bill wanted was everyone on the 49ers staff crammed inside a second-floor office facility for an emergency meeting. The tiny impromptu conference room was no match for a Bill Once all-points bulletin. At my utterance of those two words, every assistant in the building came running, which meant there weren't enough seats for everyone. Luckily, Walsh was quick and to the point. Bill wanted Steve Young. We were all highly skeptical, but also intrigued. A big part of Walsh's genius was his uncanny ability to spot a quarterback in a crowd. Even from a distance, and after only a few throws, he could sense immediately if a quarterback could run his offense. Guys like Walsh and Belichick are unusual this way. They can visualize how skill sets fit in their schemes in a way that both maximizes those abilities and fuels the system. Walsh was secretive about that particular gift of his. He never shared what he saw. So he seemed like a railbird at the track who could discern the best horses just by studying their gait around the paddock. It might have been footwork, a kinetically clean throwing motion, the way a quarterback carried himself in the pocket, or more likely some mystical balance of several quarterback qualities floating around in his head. But whatever it was, Walsh knew it when he saw it. In Walsh's first season as the head coach and general manager of the 49ers in 1979, he took a trip to UCLA to work out Olympic hurdler turned wide receiver James Owens. Owens was incredibly fast, but Walsh wanted to see if he had other skills necessary to be an NFL receiver. He forgot one small thing, though. He needed an arm to throw to the guy. As luck would have it, Notre Dame's quarterback Joe Montana was working out nearby, preparing for the draft, too. Walsh asked him to stop by. I'm not exactly sure what Walsh zeroed in on that day with Montana, but after a few throws, he was so focused on the quarterback that he practically forgot Owens was there. As a talent evaluator, you never want to rely on this kind of divine or dumb luck accidentally barring a future Hall of Fame quarterback as a workout passer or, say, drafting Tom Brady in the sixth round. But you don't want to be closed off to it either. Heck, as great as he was and as seriously as he took his profession, Walsh wasn't above a little scouting serendipity. Before the workout at UCLA began, Walsh was leaning toward drafting Stanford quarterback Steve Dills, who had played for Walsh and knew his offense inside and out. But after one or two routes at UCLA that day, Walsh knew he had found what he was looking for, his franchise quarterback. Nearly a decade later, he needed to find another. Prior to the 1987 draft, I traveled to Indianapolis with Walsh for the NFL Combine. Part of my duties at my first NFL stop was to caddy around Walsh's notebooks. This was the mid-1980s, and backpacks were an accessory for Marty McFly in Back to the Future, but no one else. Coach Walsh was not a backpack kind of guy anyway, but that was okay. It meant I had a good job, lugging around a huge briefcase stuffed with his things and mine, and lots of one-on-one time with the man. As we entered the old Hoosier Dome that day, Walsh was in a hurry, striding with purpose toward our coaches in the stands who were there to evaluate the rookie class of quarterbacks. The whole idea of having to look for a quarterback put Walsh in a sour mood. The 1986 Niners had been injury-plagued, especially at quarterback, and Walsh wasn't sure how Montana would recover from back surgery. Walsh would never actually say it, but he sensed Montana was nearing the end. As we hurried to our seats in the stands, Walsh stopped short and turned to stare at the field. Across the stadium, a few of the rookie quarterbacks, including an unknown passer from Delaware, were already on the field working out. Walsh stood like a statue as if he had gone into a trance. I had no idea who or what was holding his attention until he turned to me and barked, "Make sure Holmgren goes and sees that quarterback throwing right now." In one glimpse across the field, Walsh had seen a level of athleticism and timing from Rich Gannon that it would take the rest of the NFL a decade to figure out. When I relayed the news to our quarterback coach, Mike Holmgren, about Bill wanting, once again Bill wants, him to travel to Newark, Delaware, he was none too happy, blaming me for his itinerary as he thought I had promoted the local boy. The charge was utterly false. Sure, as a South Jersey kid, I had a fondness for all things from the Philadelphia area, but I wasn't nearly bold enough to sell a Blue Hen quarterback to Walsh, even if I wanted to. Walsh was the expert. Holmgren did eventually go to Delaware, and he liked Gannon, but he didn't love him. Gannon had a prototype size and arm strength, but Delaware's wing tee offense and the old Yankee conference weren't exactly ideal preparation for the NFL, and so Gannon was selected by the Patriots to play defensive back. Gannon had no interest in that, and after bouncing around the league from New England to Minnesota to Washington to Kansas City, he ended up paying off with the Raiders under John Gruden, who finally inserted Gannon into a scheme that perfectly fit his skills, Walsh's West Coast offense. In 2002, Gannon was named the NFL's MVP after leading the Raiders out of a nearly decade of mediocrity and back to the Super Bowl. I was with the Raiders staff at the time and remembering how Walsh had spotted Gannon's talent in an instant that day in Indiana. I couldn't help but wonder just how many potentially great quarterbacks have wasted away in the wrong system. Would Gannon's late career success have happened much earlier if we had drafted him in San Francisco? At the time, of course, Walsh really only had eyes for Steve Young. That was the message he wanted to relay to our entire staff inside that crowded second-floor conference room. As Walsh made his announcement, the faces of the assembled football minds were those of schoolboys who had sipped sour milk. Steve Young? The running quarterback? Steve Young, who was a disaster as the quarterback of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? That Steve Young? A little background. Young's college career was sensational. After leading the Brigham Young Cougars as a senior to an 11-1 record that included an impressive win over Missouri in the Holiday Bowl, he was the consensus top quarterback in the draft. But before that could happen, J. William Oldenburg bought the Los Angeles team in the upstart United States Football League and gave Young one of the biggest sports contracts ever to lead it. The four-year deal negotiated by Young's agent Lee Steinberg appeared to be worth $40 million. But then the league folded, and Young signed with the Bucks, who selected him with the first pick in a 1984 supplemental draft of USFL talent. In 2 years in Tampa, though, Young displayed better running skills than passing skills, and the Bucks had seen enough to decide it was time to try someone new. That meant Young would be a relatively cheap pickup, essentially costing a second rounder and a fourth rounder plus some of owner Edward DeBartolo Jr.'s hard-earned cash. Yes, the former most sought-after player in football was on the bargain rack, mainly because every other expert in the league felt he would never fit the traditional role. That included 99% of our staff. Now that Young is in Canton, there's a lot of revisionist history about how he came to be a 49er. For starters, Walsh had said that once he informed DeBartolo about Young, the deal was done in minutes. The truth is that he labored over the decision. In fact, he eventually held that emergency meeting to get his staff's opinion on the trade. And though lots of people will claim they knew all along that Young was destined for greatness in the NFL, I'm here to tell you that when Walsh asked for a show of hands of those who supported making the deal, none went up. Not one. Walsh actually stormed out of the room and made the deal anyway. What Walsh knew better than anyone in the game was that the key to the success in the passing era of the NFL was to marry the right quarterback to the right scheme. It's much harder than it sounds, trust me. Most of the time when the quarterback and the system clash, it's the quarterback who goes. Walsh approached challenges like this one from an entirely different perspective. That's why he had such a huge impact on the game. Early on in his coaching career, when faced with a quarterback in Cincinnati who didn't match his offense, Walsh flipped the script. He kept the quarterback and changed the offense instead, transforming the NFL along the way. In 1968, Walsh was an assistant coach for the expansion Bengals. Besides his talent as an evaluator, Walsh was a deep thinker, a student of the game, and a problem solver. His specialty was counterintuition, and it helped him solve what appeared to be an insurmountable problem in Cincinnati, a roster of castoffs that featured much less talent than every other team in the league. At that time, the NFL was still a run-dominated league. Passing was a tactic of last resort. As former Ohio State coach Woody Hayes said, three things can happen when you attempt a pass, and two of them are bad. Reliance on the forward pass was actually considered a bit cowardly, but the expansion Bengals had an undersized line and not much hope of generating a productive ground game. Walsh took a look at the dire situation and saw one thing, opportunity. Whereas most coaches would have thought that moving the ball in Cincinnati would depend on either compiling a stronger roster or throwing the ball more often, Walsh sought a less obvious solution, and most important, one that was likely to work. He had a player pool of parts, some good, some bad, and no chance in the short term to add anyone else to the mix. But if he couldn't change his players, maybe he could change the offense. In a story Walsh repeated many times, including in his posthumous book, The Score Takes Care of Itself, the inspiration for his West Coast offense was the Bengals quarterback Virgil Carter. Carter was one of the first in a long line of great quarterbacks who played at Brigham Young. At just over 6 feet, he was not an impressive physical specimen, yet he still set a host of school, conference, and NCAA records and led the Cougars to their first ever conference title in 1965. Drafted by the Bears in 1967, he played 10 games in Chicago over two seasons, throwing 193 passes with 6 touchdowns and 10 interceptions before being traded to the Bengals after the 1969 season. Carter did not have a particularly strong arm, and that was the deal breaker for most teams. Much of the league gravitated toward cannon arm throwers because passing attacks back then almost always came down to everybody go long. To this day, a quarterback who can't throw the ball with velocity usually doesn't last. But Carter had a different kind of skill set and a demeanor that intrigued Walsh. He was deadly accurate on short passes, physically and mentally nimble, and impervious to pressure. Walsh thought he could develop an offense around such a combination, one that would control the ball despite a useless running game. And controlling the ball well enough, say gaining 25 first downs a game, and playing well on special teams would put them in position to find a way to win at the end. The Bengals couldn't attack the defense vertically with strength the way everyone else did, so they would attack it horizontally with speed, using an intricately timed short passing game that essentially turned short passes into long handoffs. And just like that, as Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak changed the world from inside that small garage in Northern California, Walsh ushered in the future of football from a cramped office in Cincinnati. A future that would come to be known as the West Coast offense, the last and perhaps greatest innovation in pro football conceived in Middle America. Weirdly, Walsh's offensive success and his unique perspective on the passing attack stemmed in part from his experience as a defensive coach. He was a defensive coordinator for Marv Levy at California and the defensive backfield coach at Stanford under John Ralston. Belichick also used his defensive knowledge to design one of the most prolific offenses in modern football. Both men understood the checks and adjustments that occur within the defensive schemes. They built a counterattack by knowing their enemy. Most coaches today have been trained on only one side of the ball. Because they don't know both, they can't always effectively game plan against what the opposition is attempting. Through his defensive lens, Walsh built a system that took into account the things that Carter could offer, his football intelligence first and foremost. Football intelligence is way different from book smarts, but in this case, Carter, an academic All-American, had both. He quickly grasped the ins and outs of complex schemes, knowing what every defender was likely to do. He could do that because he was able to transfer what he learned in the classroom to the field. That is what's known as football smarts. Anyone can memorize a playbook. That's checkers. The West Coast offense is chess, and it requires a quarterback who can instantly react without thinking to any dozen or so twists and disguises a defense throws at him before and after the snap. With his football smarts, after internalizing opponents' tendencies and tape sessions, Carter can make those game speed decisions and adjustments that are in and of themselves the nervous system of Walsh's offense. If Walsh's quarterbacks needed to be quick-witted, they also needed to be quick-footed. The ability to throw in rhythm was the essential ingredient in his system. You can see it when a quarterback releases the ball on the proper step of his drop, quickly, accurately, and in synchrony with the receiver's route. In the West Coast offense, the passer and receiver's footwork is synced up like that of dance partners. As soon as Carter's back foot planted at the end of his drop, his intended target would be coming out of his break. Think of it the way an orchestra depends on each section of instruments working off the others. The attack that Walsh invented needed to be as finely tuned. He was forever reminding the quarterbacks to focus on their footwork, with each pass play requiring its own precise mechanics. Walsh let the rest of the football world focus on the quarterback's arm. He was focused on the feet. It was a paradigm shift born from the lifelong love of boxing. Walsh often shadowboxed his way down the halls of Niner headquarters, and whenever he found a fitting boxing metaphor to motivate his team, he was happy. He broke down boxers as he watched fights, their footwork, their quickness, how they moved, timing, balance. Like a boxer who can throw a flurry of punches as he deftly shuffles his feet, Walsh's quarterbacks needed their body parts to work in a similarly surgical unison. Quick feet, quick arm. Balanced feet, balanced arm. Coordinated feet, coordinated attack. Every play in Walsh's offense was designed around precision timing. All routes were synchronized such that as the quarterback hits his third or fifth step, the ball would be out of his hand and onto a ball catcher. That quick rhythm solved one of the Bengals' main weaknesses, blocking, by relieving the offensive line of having to hold blocks too long. It also allowed the receiver to become a runner beyond the line of scrimmage, in stride, and in the open field. As a result, Walsh's offensive schemes elevated the relevance of yards after the catch as they slowly transformed a run-first league into a pass-happy one. Once again, though, Walsh and his new offense were the beneficiary of great luck. Just as the West Coast was developing, the NFL made several rule changes to encourage more passing and scoring. Offensive linemen were now allowed to extend their arms and use their hands in pass blocking, essentially legalized holding, to protect the passer, and defenders no longer could redirect receivers once they got beyond 5 yards of the line of scrimmage. With more time to throw, and with pass catchers free to run across the shallow part of the field, the bread and butter of Walsh's scheme, the West Coast offense began to thrive and expand. Walsh drew up one play after another, and before long, he had a binder full of short passes that quickly got the ball out of Carter's hands and to his receivers just as they reached an open seam in the defense. He sent all his skill players out on routes, lining them up in unusual and changeable spots to stretch the field horizontally rather than vertically, the league norm. The alignments gave Carter a better pre-snap view of the defense. Walsh had created the ideal situation for a guy with a diagnostic mind and a quick, accurate arm. I have come to believe that all great coaches think alike regardless of what sport they're in. Basketball Hall of Fame coach Phil Jackson made his fame with the triangle offense, created by Sam Berry at the University of Southern California and enhanced by Tex Winter, an assistant on Jackson's staff in Chicago and Los Angeles. The triangle was basketball's way of creating clear passing lanes. Simply described, when the ball is thrown into the post, that player and two others on the same side of the ball form the points of a well-spaced triangle. Walsh's passing game was essentially the triangle on turf. When you break down any fundamental plays of the West Coast offense, the same geometric shape forms inside the defense, a triangle. For example, say you have two backs in split formation in the backfield and the tight end on the line to the right. Now the Z receiver, the one on the tight end side, runs a 12-yard curl while the tight end runs to a spot that is exactly in front of the location of the snap when the play started at a depth of 5 yards where he can't legally be bumped off his route. Meanwhile, one back swings out toward the sideline of the Z receiver's curl. Hit pause and draw a line from that back to the Z receiver to the tight end, and what do you get? An isosceles triangle. The formation means the West Coast quarterback is never looking at a particular receiver. Rather, he is looking toward the apex of the triangle and then decides where the ball should go depending on the coverage or the spacing. Walsh hated to see quarterbacks locking in on a receiver early in his route because defenses can see that too. But when quarterbacks instead key on the area of the field, the triangle, defenders don't quite know what or who they are guarding, especially if the receiver makes a late break, coming free just as the quarterback hits his launch step in his drop. Spacing, timing, and rhythm. Seems simple enough, but it's actually put stagnant, slow defenses unaccustomed to adaptation at a huge disadvantage. So much so, in fact, that in the first year of the new offense, just the third year of the team's existence, Carter, Walsh, and the Bengals won the AFC Central. In so doing, Walsh had proved something revolutionary in the typically risk and innovation-averse NFL, that quarterbacks with a different skill set could lead successful attacks so long as the passer matched the scheme. When it comes to evaluating quarterbacks, pedigree and prototypical size, speed, and arm strength will always matter. But thanks to Walsh, such things as intelligence, poise, and precision also become important. More than anything, Walsh coveted accuracy from his passers. It's what allowed the receivers the opportunity to run with the ball after the catch. If a tight end with his back turned to the defense was open in an empty zone, Walsh expected the quarterback to throw away from the oncoming defender to let the pass catcher know where that defender was and which way he should run to avoid him. Fans of a certain age have the play known simply as the catch, indelibly etched in the part of their brain reserved for important historical moments. In the 1981 NFC Championship game against the Cowboys, 49ers quarterback Joe Montana threw the ball so high and toward the back of the end zone that it almost appeared to be a throwaway. But that throwaway was in fact precisely where Walsh wanted it, because the only person who could catch it was receiver Dwight Clark. For Walsh, throwing to the back end line always meant throwing high, whereas throwing near the goal line meant throwing low, because in both cases, the ball could be caught by a 49er or it would be incomplete. High throws near the goal line could be tipped and intercepted. For similar reasons, he was never a big believer in small receivers because wingspan and catch radius could only help the quarterback. He left no detail to chance. And all those details were harmoniously linked. To push the game forward, Walsh was constantly looking back through history for guidance and inspiration. Walsh pored over the old tapes of teams coached by Clark Shaughnessy, a longtime college mainstay and a big believer in the T formation, quarterback behind center, two running backs spread perpendicularly behind him, finding them intriguing even though there were few forward passes in any of them. Rather, he watched for blocking schemes, which set off offensive linemen at angles to defenders instead of having them face the rush head-on. Those side blocks made it easier for less talented players to seal off defenders while providing a more unobstructed path for the back to follow. Many disparaged the West Coast offense as more finesse than power, partially because angle blocks outnumbered drive blocks. But helping players get an edge is not finesse. It's just smart. Similarly, with the old T formation, the ball handling confused the linebackers as they watched the ball instead of the blocking scheme, causing them to be slightly out of position. And in the run game, being even a little bit in the wrong spot can create a lane big enough for a back to scoot through. In the end, though, the most significant influence for Walsh was his time spent with the Raiders. Oakland's passing game, which, to be fair, was preceded by Sid Gilman's air attack, was a precursor to the West Coast offense in the way it freed the linemen from having to protect the quarterback for too long through the use of short passes and quick releases. Yes, Davis preferred throwing the ball down the field, but he too believed strongly in the timing between the quarterback and receiver. Everybody had to be in sync. That included tight ends and running backs, which in those days were a rarity. With those players involved, there were often five route runners who had to be covered, thus overwhelming defenses. Of course, that was when things worked just right, which they rarely do. But even in the typical chaos that takes place on a football field, Walsh still managed to find something useful. In another story that Walsh loved to tell and write about, Cincinnati's tight end Bob Trumpy, facing the Raiders, once broke the huddle and lined up on the right side instead of on the left, where the play called for him to be. The quarterback shifted him to the other side in time to run the play correctly, and when Trumpy came to the sideline when the series was over, he was apologetic. The Bengals coaches, though, particularly the offensive line coach Bill Johnson, barely heard him because they were still marveling at the fact that when Trumpy moved, four defenders followed him and actually ran into one another in the confusion, which meant that when he ran back to where he was supposed to be, the Raiders were not where they were supposed to be. Defenses always set their fronts and coverage packages against the strength of the offense, that is, the side on which the tight end lines up. When Trumpy moved, the strength of the defense moved too, and when he moved back, it had to realign. The shift added another complicated layer to the defense's communication while forcing the defense to tip its hand just before the snap. Once Johnson and Walsh saw this, they knew they could mess with the defense, get it out of position, and confuse its communication. Thus, out of a broken play, the shift was reborn as a major weapon in the West Coast offense. Believe it or not, the run was also a weapon in Walsh's new scheme. Walsh was weaned in a time when establishing the run was agreed to be the most critical component of winning football. But he was the first to realize that everyone was chasing a lie. He correctly understood that teams interested only in establishing the run were creating nothing more than a chance to kick a field goal. Think about it. The odds of covering 80 yards, more or less, on the ground are not good. One negative play pretty much stalls a drive. One pass play of, say, 20 yards, though, dramatically changes field position and a team's chances of driving to a touchdown. Walsh's West Coast offense was an anti-run. He just wanted to run the ball with a creativity that would give the players the best chance to succeed. Running every play between the tackles was not for him. In fact, he saw the traditional run game as the lazy coach's way, putting the onus on players to execute or rely on the brute force for yardage. That was something Walsh always wanted to avoid. That's why Walsh's teams, not to mention the best teams in football today, came out throwing. If you were to plot the rushing attempts of recent playoff teams by quarter, it would look like this. First quarter, a rush-to-pass percentage in the bottom third of the league. Second quarter, same. Third quarter, middle of the pack. Fourth quarter, top third, more or less. Examine the regular season breakdowns of teams that made it to the Super Bowl after the 2016 season. In the first half, the Patriots threw the ball 57% of the time and ran it 43%. The Falcons threw it 61% of the time and rushed just 39%. But in the second half, the Pats were more 50-50 and the Falcons 54-46. Walsh was the first NFL coach to foresee the paradigm shift on offense and how the run one day would become more about preserving the lead than establishing it. Maybe if the Falcons had stuck to the plan and run the ball more in the fourth quarter of Super Bowl 51, they would have won the game. Old schoolers think establishing the run is a quarterback's best friend. But what kind of friend is third and long when everyone in the stadium knows you have to pass the ball? In truth, conservative play calling is a quarterback's worst enemy. The best thing an offense can do for its quarterback is throw on traditional rundowns so that the quarterback doesn't have to deal with the obvious passing situations. Throwing the ball makes running the ball easier, and that's how Walsh succeeded with the Bengals. In the first few years of what was derisively called the dink and dunk offense, Walsh found success not so much in scoring points, but in getting first downs and keeping the ball away from the opponent. Defenses were slow to adjust, continuing to play as if they were expecting the Bengals to throw down the field. Pretty soon, the defenses found themselves in even worse trouble as the Bengals added more talented pieces to the offense, receivers such as Isaac Curtis, Charlie Joyner, and Chip Myers, whose speed allowed Walsh to add a downfield element to his short game. The first down machine had been transformed into a scoring machine. Thanks to what Walsh did in Cincinnati, NFL teams started to think of their offenses the way baseball executives think of their stadiums. Baseball teams collect talent that makes the most sense for the quirks of their home parks. The Red Sox stockpile right-handed hitters because the Green Monster in left is so close. More cavernous stadiums become homes to speedier players. Stadiums dictate style.